We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you both back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Got to take a vacation once in a while.
Oh, wow. Okay.
What's that?
Yeah, read about those. I remember those. Okay, so tons to cover, starting out with a very important date that
this Tuesday is the primary election. If you have your ballot, mark it and mail it as soon as you can. I would do it today or Monday, not wait till Tuesday. If you don't have your ballot, if you're not registered and you still want to vote anyway, you can go to the, King County Vote Centers, and there are several vote centers in King County. They're going to be open today until 4 p.m. On Monday, they'll be open from 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Tuesday, 8:30 a.m. until 8 p.m., that's Election Day. You can go and register and vote at the same time. There's one located at Lumen Field Events Center at 800 Occidental Avenue South. That's where Occidental and Royal Brougham Way meet. And there's one at Bellevue College Cafeteria at 3000 Landerholm Circle Southeast. And, of course, you can also go to the King County Elections Office in Renton at 919 Southwest Grady Way. But there are also ones in Federal Way in Kent and Kenmore if those are closer to you. Just go online and Google King County Election Center, King County Vote Center, and you can find the one nearest you. You can go and register and vote at the same time. And I want to remind people that if you've been convicted of a felony in Washington State and you've already served your time, your right to vote is automatically restored to you. But you will have to go and register to vote. And I hope that you will, because this election is particularly important for public safety reasons and for public safety reform.
And so most of our audience consists of convicted felons. That's an important thing to pass along.
You never know.
It's true.
You never know.
We definitely have a healthy representation there.
Yep. Yeah.
So. And I'm proud of it.
The same day registration and vote thing is kind of new for Washington State, and King County is trying to make it easy for people to register and vote, and I hope that folks will take advantage of that. And like I say, those vote centers are open today until 4 p.m., so if you want to do it on a day off, today is a great day to do that. But they'll also be open till 6 p.m. on Monday and until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, Election Day.
And if you are mailing it, you really want to mail it in today and not wait to take chances with Monday, because that's dicey.
Yeah.
Remember that the post office has already been screwed with by the former president, and that a lot of that service has not been restored. I would also consider using drop boxes, of which you can find the full list at the King County Elections website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And those are more plentiful than the locations that Maria previously gave. So.
Yeah, and reserve the vote centers for people who want to register, because they're going to be pretty busy. So if you're just turning in a ballot, I would suggest going to one of the ballot boxes near you. Now, in other election news, too, King County Elections this week certified Charter Amendment 29 for the November election this year. Now, the proponents, that's the Compassion Seattle crew, turned in about 66,000 signatures, and King County certified 34,714 of those as valid. The initiative needed 33,060 valid signatures to qualify. And looking at those numbers, though, I have to say that's a really high rejection rate when nearly half of them are thrown out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you gave those numbers, that was the first thing I thought of. Yeah.
Yeah. And the most common reason for throwing out that high number of signatures was that the signees were not registered to vote in the city of Seattle. So, yeah, crazy but true, you know. You have to be a Seattle voter to sign a petition that would change the Seattle City Charter. So apparently people didn't understand that when they signed the initiative. Nevertheless,
or they paid signature gatherers, just never asked.
Yeah, just didn't ask. And nevertheless, the Seattle City Council will now vote on Monday to include the Charter Amendment 29 on the November ballot, because I don't think they're going to pass it into law instead. That still leaves the Sewant Recall initiative hanging out there. And we're still waiting to see if they will turn in enough signatures by early August to qualify for the November ballot instead of a special election in February. Now, I understand that a number of Sewant supporters are actually gathering signatures for the Recall Sewant initiative in the hopes that the sponsors of the initiative will turn in their signatures early and get it on the ballot for November. Because they're thinking that more Sewant supporters will be voting in November and are likely to overturn the recall initiative than would be in a special election in February. So we'll see, and we're just waiting. I'm sure that that's going to be in another week or two. We'll hear more about that. And also, in the final week before the election, I've noticed that mainstream Democrats in Seattle have been wringing their hands over the spike in shootings recently. And this is giving them a lot of fodder for a tough on crime pushback against the progressive candidates who are running for office. Polls have been pretty few and far between in this election, but it looks like progressives Nikita Oliver and Teresa Mosqueda may win election to the city council, and that current council president Lorena Gonzalez is in the top two ranking for the mayoral race. And this is making some of the mainstream Democrats pro-business Democrats in Seattle kind of sweat. But I should point out, too, that those polls have a very high percentage of undecided voters. So the pro-business Democrats are seeing this as an opportunity to push the narrative that the current city council is too far left and has decimated the Seattle Police Department's budget, and so is responsible for a surge in crime in Seattle. For example, this week in the Seattle Times, there was a column by Danny Westneat saying that the city council is directly responsible for the spike in shootings, just basically laying it at their doorstep. So it's really important, I think, to point out two things. One, the city council did not decimate the Seattle Police Department's budget. They cut it by 6%, and that was the first cut that the Seattle Police Department's budget has taken in recent history. Even through a couple of very bad economic downturns, the Seattle Police Department's budget has never been cut before. And that 6% is a very small cut, actually. And the second thing I want to point out is that there is now a nationwide increase in crime, especially shootings, mass shootings, gang
shootings. And especially in large cities.
Yeah, mass shootings, gang shootings, and domestic violence have all gone up during the pandemic. That is not the Seattle City Council's fault. And just think for a minute about the pandemic shutdown and the kind of stress that's put on families and the kind of economic stress it's put on people who have been laid off from work. Now, weirdly, in 2020, Americans bought a record number of guns, 23 million of them, which is a 65% increase over 2019. It was almost as if Americans needed a gun in addition to a face mask in order to feel safe from COVID-19. Okay. So that could be, I think, a much more direct cause for the rise in shootings than trying to lay it all at the feet of the city council. So, and this is, of course, why addressing gun violence is super important in this election year. But I have to say that hiring more police, which is something that Mayor Durkan and the mainstream press and mainstream pro-business Democrats are really pushing for, is probably not going to help.
This might be a good time to talk about the Urban Institute study, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so Mayor Durkan commissioned a study that was conducted by the Urban Institute that found that about 49% of 911 calls in the city of Seattle over the last 3 years did not require sworn officers with guns to respond.
That was the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. But go ahead.
Yeah. So this raises the question, and of course, you know, they broke out a number of recommendations for a four-tier system for dispatching, only the fourth of which would require SPD officers to respond
to be
without
the first
question.
Responders. Yeah.
To be the first responders. Yes. You know, it's a lot of the others are like, you know, mental health calls, welfare checks, things for which guns are not going to improve the situation.
Yeah.
And in fact, have an unfortunate history of situations going sideways.
Yeah. So, now, in that study, I think it said, I was looking at the breakdown, and it said over 80% of the calls are for nonviolent crimes. And they included a breakdown of how they classified the calls. 67% or two-thirds of them were non-criminal. Non-criminal.
Yeah.
Okay. 20% were for misdemeanors. Okay. 5% were nonviolent felonies, and only 8% were serious violent felonies.
So why exactly do we need more cops?
Right. So that gives you a really different picture of crime in Seattle, right? From what we're hearing in the mainstream media, from the Seattle Police Department, the mayor's office, and some of the candidates who are running for mayor and city council this year, it's really telling us that only about 12% of the calls to 911 involve serious felonies and only 8% involve violence. Okay. Now, the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform in their report said that about 12% of the calls, quote, can and should be explored for alternative responses in the near future, suggesting that the city should immediately stand up a civilian team to respond to those non-criminal calls. And as in that four-tier system they were talking about, the first one or two tiers could handle the bulk of the calls, and those would be using a civilian, unarmed person or persons as the first responders. Now, a Seattle Police Department spokesman responded negatively to this, saying that sometimes police are dispatched proactively to areas where shootings have occurred in the past as a way to prevent violence. However, this brings up the issue of police over-patrolling neighborhoods of color and harassing people, particularly young men. Community justice projects, I should point out, are meant to step into this area and replace the police's, quote-unquote, proactive policing of neighborhoods of color. Okay, so there's a cultural change that has to happen there, too.
And when you hear, for instance, political candidates talking for instance, Bruce Harrell talk about SPD using, you know, data-driven metrics.
Yeah.
What they're talking about is determining what neighborhoods to send police to based upon past arrests. Now, of course, if the past arrests have been racially biased, then that's going to inform where those officers are proactively sent as well. So it's a feedback loop, and that's what they're talking about.
It's going to increase tensions, and, yeah, that's a downward spiral. Now, I should point out, too, that Seattle would not be the first city to set up a team of unarmed community responders. Denver, Baltimore, or Eugene, Oregon, and Olympia have all set up similar teams.
Yeah, New York City has a pilot program that appears to be very successful as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, that leads into some of the other public safety news that I have this week. Mayor Durkin, Council Member Lisa Herbold, Interim Police Chief Adrian Diaz, and other members of the city's public safety team announced the formation of a new 911 triage team to handle non-critical, non-violent 911 calls, including what are called person down calls, where a person is found sleeping or unconscious in public, but would also handle calls like based on things like littering and graffiti and noise complaints, for example. Now, the majority of person down calls usually involve substance abuse or someone having a health crisis. And SPD, a 911 policy, is to dispatch two uniformed officers to the scene as first responders. But when they get there, there usually isn't much that they can do except call another agency, like an ambulance or the fire department's Health One team. You don't need a person with a gun and a badge to call Health One to do that kind of work, really. Triage One, which is its working name for right now. It could be called something else when it's eventually set up, would not be housed in the Seattle Police Department or the Fire Department. It would be run directly from the 911 Dispatch Center, which is now housed within the city's new Communications and Community Safety Center. Was all moved out of the Seattle Police Department budget this year and into its own department within the city budget. Now, Triage One, Durkin said that she expects it to be set up and running next year and that it would respond to about 1,000 calls per year, mainly within the downtown core. And then this week, Councilmember Herbold, who is the chair of the city's public safety committee, said this week that the city council's public safety committee said this week that she doesn't want to wait that long and she would like to see the council provide funding to stand up the team in the second half of this year. And I'm sure the city council would like to see the team respond to calls throughout the entire city, not just the downtown core. So expect to see some bills in city council in the coming weeks that would set the stage for defining the structure, the name for the team, the number of team members, and passing some legal changes within the city to allow that team to work as first responders. Now, what differentiates the triage team from the fire department's Health One team, in case you're wondering, is that Health One is trained to respond to people with substance abuse problems, medical issues, and mental health crises, and to provide immediate support or an appropriate referral on the spot. Triage One would handle less acute calls, or step in before Health One to determine if Health One needs to be called so that you don't have to have Seattle police be the first responders and do that instead. So that's the difference between those, would be the difference between those two teams. So that's kind of interesting. And that came directly out of the report we talked about before from the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform. Now, also in public safety news this week, a little over a week ago, the Office of the Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department released its first report on the Seattle Police Department's response to the George Floyd protests last summer. This first report looked at incidents that arose from the police firing pepper spray, tear gas, blast balls, and other quote-unquote crowd control munitions at protesters during the first week of protests from May 30th, first weekend of protests from May 30th to June 1st of last year. The OIG makes 54 recommendations in their report for changes at the Seattle Police Department, but among them are a couple of very key policy changes at the Seattle Police Department, which are getting some criticism in the local media and from pro-business politicians. The first recommendation is for the Seattle Police Department to change its policy that prevents police officers from showing solidarity for a movement or expressing a political opinion while on duty. The OIG panel pointed to numerous times when Seattle protesters demanded a response from SPD officers to the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers, but SPD officers couldn't respond because of department policy, even though many agreed with the protesters. Being able to take a knee or wear black armbands, for example, or at least respond in some way, could have diffused the situation in a lot of instances. Now, Inspector General Lisa Judge also pointed out that the SPD officers who didn't agree with the protesters felt free to hurl verbal abuse at them in spite of an SPD policy that forbids officers from using profanity or derogatory language toward any person, regardless of their behavior. The OIG panel reviewed videos of numerous instances in which this policy was not followed. So while that SPD policy prevents officers from showing solidarity with protesters, it doesn't obviously doesn't prevent officers from hate speech against those same protesters when they don't agree with them. Now, the second policy change that the OIG recommended is for the Seattle Police Department to move away from the concepts of crowd control and crowd management, which has led to some very bad tactics, like forcing a crowd to move, chasing people and arresting them or beating them when they can't run, or surrounding a crowd so that people can't leave when they want to, sometimes referred to as corralling a crowd.
Or kettling, yeah.
Instead, the OIG recommended a policy of, quote, crowd facilitation and crowd safety, end quote, so that people can engage in their First Amendment rights without fear of being gassed, beaten, arrested, and sometimes severely injured. I should point out at this stage that crowd facilitation and safety was the policy of the Seattle Police Department in the 1980s and 90s. Before the WTO protests. Only after the WTO protests shut down Seattle for a week did the Seattle Police Department's policy change to one of don't let crowds form, and when they do, punish the crap out of them. You know? And it's been that policy ever since, this sort of crowd control, crowd management, forced dispersal, disregard for people's First Amendment rights, and punish people whenever and wherever you can just for showing up.
It would be very interesting to see how much that policy has cost the city in lawsuits over the last 20 years.
It would be good, yeah, if somebody could go back and kind of look at all that. And I should say, too, in response to this policy that the Seattle Police Department has had since the WTO protests, we now have crowds where some folks engage in property destruction almost as a matter of form, partly because they really, really, really hate the police. And it doesn't always begin, you know, right away. But typically, as soon as the police attack the crowd and try to force the crowd to disperse or force the crowd to move, people will then take out their frustrations on nearby property. I've seen it again and again and again.
To be perfectly honest, the other problem with this is it means the protests attract a certain type
of
usually young protesters who really are into the street battles.
Yeah.
And you know, the focus of the protests then becomes we hate the police rather than whatever the issue of the day is.
Yeah. And that's really unfortunate, but it absolutely is in reaction to this SPD policy of disperse people as soon as possible, you know, crowd management and, making sure that you punish people just for showing up and trying to exercise their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, and so, if one person throws a water bottle, punish the whole crowd.
Yeah, exactly. Now, also in the news this week, Seattle Police Department officer Captain Steve Herjack is suing the city over his demotion 2 months ago for the misuse of crowd control weapons against protesters on June 1st of last year during the George Floyd protests. The Office of Police Accountability had instead recommended that Interim Chief Adrian Diaz demote Lieutenant John Brooks, who was the on-site commander during the protests. But Diaz didn't do that. Instead, he announced that he had information no one else did, and that the person he was going to demote was actually Commander Steve Herjack. Now, both the Community Police Commission And Councilmember Lisa Herbold at that time questioned his decision, saying that any additional information he had should be released to the three oversight bodies, the OPA, the Community Police Commission, and the OIG. Diaz responded by saying that he just lacked confidence in Herjack, which was why he was demoting him. Notably, Herjack was appointed the Seattle Police Department's first Asian American assistant chief in 2018, which I find particularly interesting given that this city has had a significant Asian American population since its founding in 1851. That Herjack would be the first Asian American to be promoted to command level in the SPD. Now, in his lawsuit, Herjack points out that the OPA has recommended that former Chief Best and Interim Chief Diaz discipline a number of white commanders who have not been demoted, and at least a couple of whom have been promoted, including John Brooks, who was promoted within the past year to the post of acting captain of the unit that leads the SPD's response to protests. Brooks was the subject of 14 misconduct investigations in 2020. So it seems that Herjack has a really good case in claiming that Interim Chief Diaz may have discriminated against him because of his race and demoted him instead of the person who the OPA found was actually responsible for the SPD's abuse of protesters on June 1st. Yeah. Now, the city has a couple of weeks to begin mediation with Herjack. If the city decides not to go to mediation, then Herjack can file his lawsuit in court. And I expect that will probably be the case.
Yeah. Speaking of lack of accountability, Publicola had a very good story this week about the large number of SPD officers who not only have not faced accountability, but in some cases have been promoted after facing serious domestic violence allegations. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, domestic violence is very difficult to prove in court. Not least because the victims often choose not to testify, and you might particularly choose not to testify if your abuser is an officer with a gun. So SPD doesn't seem to be too concerned about this, but it's a story well worth checking out. The culture of misogyny within SPD is alive and well. I've heard a number of stories over the years from women who say that, you know, SPD officers not only will not enforce restraining orders, but often side with the abusers and say that they don't, quote, believe in restraining orders. So, you know, the SPD seems to have a cultural problem with domestic violence issues, and particularly with misogyny. Not surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And then, speaking of jerks, SPOG head Mike Solon was in the news this week for saying that voters in Seattle's primary election should elect, quote-unquote, moderate people to, quote, save Seattle from, quote, the activist Twitter mob. This tells me that Solon is worried that more of his officers are going to lose their jobs. Notably, the budget cuts so far to SPD have not involved any kind of a reduction in sworn numbers, sworn officers.
I believe that a number of the officers who have been leaving the Seattle Police Department are the ones that have a history of bad behavior and are not looking forward to the cultural changes that the city is trying to make within the Seattle Police Department.
Yes, although given how long the reform process has been going on, you would think that, efforts to change the culture within SPD that have been tried and failed over the past decade, I'm not sure what additional strategies are in the works that might be more effective,
mm-hmm.
Other than maybe, you know, dismantling the entire department.
Yeah, we'll see. Now, the new mayor that we're going to get after November's election will be in a prime position to help select a new chief of police. So that could also be one of the things that Solon is worried about, a new city council and a new mayor who may be looking for a police chief who is going to push harder for reform at the Seattle Police Department. That would be my guess.
Yes.
Now, in some good news this week, in the local realm, the King County Council picked a new head of its police oversight board. They voted 8-1 with only Pete von Reichbauer, that old dinosaur, voting against him to hire, and I hope he forgives me for mispronouncing his name if I do. Tamer Abuzaid as the head of the county's Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, which oversees complaints against the King County Sheriff's Department. Now, Abuzaid
has... We don't spend as much time on that as we do on SPD, but King County Sheriff's Office has a long, long history of many of the same problems.
Oh, yes. And I know in demonstrations that I've been to, when you see the King County Police show up, it's like, oh, God. Here come the real brutes, right? Okay. So Abuzaid, I should say, has a long history of activism related to police accountability and reform. He was an investigator in the Chicago Police Oversight Office from 2018 to 2020 and has served as a staff attorney for the Chicago Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations. His law degree is from Georgetown University. He's also worked as the legal counsel for the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. That's a group that was formed in the wake of the police riots during the 1968 Democratic National Convention and the police attacks against the Black Panther Party in Chicago during that era. And folks may remember that Chicago Panther Fred Hampton was assassinated by Chicago police in 1969. And this group was formed in direct response to that. Abuzaid told the King County Council that he would look to the community for guidance on how to conduct oversight of the sheriff's office. He promised to work on separating the issue of police oversight from any new King County Police Officers Guild contract. So he expects that will not be on the negotiating table during any union contract. He also supports mandating body cameras for sheriff's deputies, something that Sheriff Mitzi Johannicht has promised, but has not, which has not happened yet, probably because of pushback from the King County Police Officers Guild. Next year, whoever wins the election this year as King County Executive, whether it's Dow Constantine or Joe Wynn, will appoint a new sheriff to replace Johannicht. And the county council will vote on that appointment. I'm sure they'll probably consult Abuzaid on that candidate as well. Now, Abuzaid looks like a really good appointment for this office, which has had problems with its past two directors. Deborah Jacobs was removed because of inappropriate comments she made to her staff. And the first head of the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, Charles Gaither, left back in 2014 and then sued the county on allegations of racial discrimination because of harassment he had received from Sheriff John Urquhart and his staff. So that's a kind of troubled history for the first oversight board for the King County Sheriff's Department. And I hope that Abuzaid will be able to move forward with reform measures without encountering that same kind of harassment. And this is hopefully a step forward for oversight of the King County Sheriff's Department.
And obviously community support.
I know Claudia Balducci on the King County Council was very supportive of Abuzaid. I know that Guirme Zahale was very supportive of him as well. So he looks like an extremely good candidate to run the department.
All right. Good. So that's the good news.
So that's the very good news this week. Moving forward on county police oversight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's move on. We didn't get to hear from either of you last week, but the pandemic continues to come back for, I guess it got it renewed for another season.
Yeah, yes. Well, so much for the good news, right?
Yeah.
Washington State is one of only 50 states that has an increasing caseload right now. At least one day this week, the state was over 1,000 new cases. The good news is the hospitalizations are not terribly high, although a lot of local area hospitals are reporting that they're full. Now, it's not clear how many of those are actually COVID cases versus, for example, people who had been delaying elective surgeries who are now going back to get them because they weren't able to over the past year and a half. Certainly the hospitals have been busy. Local case numbers are particularly bad in Snohomish County. They're also going up in King and Pierce, areas of eastern Washington as well. So we are definitely not out of the woods. And, the news has been dominated this week by the CDC, which has been backpedaling furiously on its previous guidances on a number of different fronts. We've seen preliminary data that was, had been trickling out over the past couple of weeks that led toward this moment, but, it all came at once this week. So we had, for instance, the CDC finding that a July 4th outbreak in Provincetown, Massachusetts involved, 75% vaccinated people and found through genetic sequencing that, vaccinated people were able to spread it to other vaccinated people, the Delta variant, that is. So we now know.
Yeah, I think they took nose and throat swabs that showed that vaccinated people have the same amount of virus in their nose and their throats as unvaccinated people. And so they theorized and through the genetic sequencing, they realized that vaccinated people, yes, can spread, the Delta variant of COVID-19, which really changes the whole playing field.
Yeah.
Really.
And it also, reminds us that because it's, an intramuscular vaccine injection that goes into the bloodstream. It does not go so it's designed to prevent the virus from spreading to your lungs, which is, was the understanding that we had of COVID at the time that the vaccines were starting to be developed. But we now know that, the viral loads particularly concentrate in nasal passages, that they can infect people long before they get to the lungs. So what we're seeing is, fewer overall hospitalizations, fewer really serious cases, but the number of new cases is still getting to be very high.
Yeah. And unfortunately, about half of Americans are not vaccinated. And those unvaccinated folks are the ones who are making up the very serious cases that are being hospitalized, and people are still dying from COVID-19 at a time when no one should be dying from COVID-19.
Yeah, and you can see that the case and hospitalization rates are particularly skyrocketing in exactly the states that have low vaccination rates.
Yeah.
So, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Florida, Texas, all the usual suspects. Those are the states that are getting hammered right now.
Yeah. But even in states where over that 70% of adults vaccinated, and you would expect us to begin to get what's called herd immunity or some kind of resistance to the spread, we're not even close. If vaccinated people can still get it, not have any or many symptoms and spread it so easily, it really tells us that COVID-19 is now endemic in the human population and we're not going to be able to eradicate it, which means two things. More people need to get vaccinated. The other half of America needs to bite the bullet and get the shot. Because until they do, they're at risk of significant illness and death. Okay. And the other thing is that vaccinated people need to continue to be cautious and wear a mask when they're indoors. And
yes,
and we
heard that from the CDC this week.
Yeah, and that's everywhere, not just in the 74% of counties which are seeing an upsurge in the virus. 74% meaning almost three quarters of counties everywhere in the United States, including King, Snohomish, and Pierce County. And that for our listeners, that means wear a mask, get takeout from your favorite restaurant. Don't sit indoors and eat there. Don't hang out in bars and coffee shops. And, you know, continue to wear a mask when you go to the grocery store and the drugstore and when you ride the bus and so forth. So
yeah,
that's really what it means.
Which I can tell you from my trips to the grocery store this week, the percentage of people wearing masks dropped significantly from.
Which is crazy. Anytime you're indoors with people you don't know, you have to be wearing a mask. And I say that because you don't know who's immunocompromised. And what we know is that immunocompromised people are not really able to make antibodies with just two doses of the vaccine. They're now recommending that immunocompromised people get three or four doses of the vaccine. And even then, they may not make antibodies.
Yes, there are several countries where immunocompromised people, and for that matter, people over the age of 60, are getting booster shots. The CDC has not recommended that yet. It had a panel that met to discuss that this week, but it has not issued any guidance on that yet.
Yeah. I think they're waiting to see with the folks who are getting in European countries who are getting a third or a fourth shot to see what that does for their immunity.
Well, France has been doing it since April, so I'm not sure what the delay is, honestly.
Yeah.
And I say that as an immunocompromised person myself. So
I think I know that the CDC is also looking at the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And what they're finding is that a single shot of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is probably not enough, that those folks would get a much better immune response if they went back and got a second dose of that vaccine as well. So that's something to consider, too, if you're in the higher risk group, like over 60, or if you have comorbidities that put you at higher risk.
Yeah.
And we should also remember, too, that young children have not been approved for the vaccine. And it's a myth that kids don't get COVID. It's a myth that they don't get seriously ill from it, because they can get very seriously ill and can die from COVID-19, especially very, very young children, including babies and young toddlers whose immune systems are not fully developed yet. So, you know, for compassion's sake, if you're not going to take care of yourself, for compassion's sake, for your friends and family, for young children that your friends have or that your family members have, for the elderly in your family, you have to go get the vaccine.
Yeah, and wear a mask when you're in a public place. Mm-hmm. And keep socially distancing, too.
Yeah.
So the CDC also issued a guidance this week for K-12 students saying that they should all be wearing masks. And we're already seeing pushback on that from the usual suspects. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis issued an executive order yesterday barring schools from enforcing that and saying parents should be free to choose whether their kids will wear masks, get vaccinated or not. I suppose.
Yeah, some of us would argue that
the phrase child abuse comes to mind.
Yeah, is child abuse or child neglect, which amounts to the same thing. Medical neglect is a form of child abuse. I need to point out.
Yeah. And we also had a competing executive order from fellow 2024 Republican presidential hopeful Greg Abbott of Texas that basically consolidated all of his previous orders barring localities from requiring masks, requiring vaccinations, you know, any of the stuff that might help, basically, which really raises the question, why do Republicans want to kill off their own constituents? I don't know the answer to that. It's a rhetorical question, but it is a relevant one and certainly has been for the last year and a half. So yeah, not a good news cycle for COVID news this week.
I think the main driver there is their willingness to keep their constituents scared and supportive of their extreme policies. I think is the main driver there.
Yeah, and quite frankly, anytime in the history of the 20th or 21st century that you've had authoritarian governments, they have shown a cavalier disregard for their own constituents' health and safety. Mm-hmm. That seems to be baked into the ideology. So go figure. Yeah. I do think, though, that it is a helpful measure of just how authoritarian-leaning the Republican Party has become.
Yeah.
So,
but this is all taking place with the backdrop of that here in Washington State, for instance, pretty much business has gone back to its usual stances of being open for business, and people are packing in the bars and restaurants and,
Social life is going back to normal. I wouldn't say businesses are. There's a significant number of businesses, particularly in the downtown core, who have not reopened, and their plans are to reopen in August or September. I think that may be delayed now because of the Delta variant. We'll just have to see.
Yeah, and some of those storefronts just aren't coming back at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. Downtown in particular is hurting pretty badly right now.
Yeah. But Mike is right too, because I think something like more than 30 new restaurants opened in the past week or two here in the city of Seattle. So, that's really showing that I think our social life is wakening up again, and people are trying to go back to business as usual in that regard. And I think that's a mistake.
Well, I remember criticizing the state's reopening when it happened last month.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was premature then, and I stand by that.
There are now people are compiling lists of the different nightlife spots that in Seattle that are now requiring you to show proof of vaccination before they will allow you to enter. Theoretically,
yeah. And there were, I think, 9 different bars in Seattle that had to shut down last weekend because of COVID outbreaks among their staff. So again, wear masks.
These are people who are vaccinated for the most part.
Yep.
So yeah.
All right.
It's like I said, it's endemic now. It's something that I think we can all count on getting COVID at some point. The question is it going to be a super serious disease for you because you didn't get vaccinated, or are you going to be able to shake it off because you did get vaccinated? And if you're older, if you're over 60 years old and you're an older person or you're immunocompromised, how long can you go without getting it? And how many vaccines and booster shots do you need in order to keep you safe?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of it is, at least for, I think, people in general, is there's so many mixed messages. Even if you discount the anti-vax folks, just coming from, let's say, someone like Governor Jay Inslee that constantly goes back and forth on different issues, that you can kind of understand when I walked into Safeway earlier this week and there was a significant percentage of people not wearing masks, even though that day they'd come out and said, hey, we're, encouraging people to put masks back on, even though if they have been vaccinated. You could see where there's this confusion that if you're not, following this closely, like you two have, that, that's contributing to the problem.
Well, and honestly, a lot of that has flowed from the CDC, which has been really scrupulous in trying to follow the best available science, but the public messaging has been terrible because people don't understand that science evolves and our understanding of the virus is evolving and that, situations change. The Delta variant was not well understood when it first emerged. We're learning more about it now, and everything we learn is bad, basically.
Scientific education among the American population is just abysmal. So a lot of people just don't understand how fast viruses mutate, and that the more people who get sick from COVID-19, the more likely we are to have these new variants arise. And of course, it's a global economy now. It's a global world now. It's so easy for people to travel from country to country. And there are so many countries where there is hardly any vaccine available that new variants are going to arise. And we need to be prepared for that eventuality. And that means vigilance. And it means continuing to wear a mask. And it means that as many people as possible must get the vaccine.
Yeah. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, please don't delay anymore.
All right. We've only got 10 minutes left. Jov, updates this week on the former president of the United States and his family.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there was a lot of news about Trump this week. The Department of Justice issued a couple of key rulings. One is that the Treasury Department can release Trump's taxes to the House Oversight Committee that had been trying to get them for the past 2 years. That may open the president, a former president, up to additional criminal investigations or charges. We also saw that the DOJ is not interested in defending congressional Republicans who were claiming that they needed to be defended against lawsuits stemming from the January 6th riot because in the case particularly of Mo Brooks of Alabama, the incendiary speech he gave at the Ellipse that morning was in the context of his official duties. Now, how he figures that, who knows? But the Justice Department decided that, no, that actually wasn't your official duties. That was a campaign speech. That's on your own dime. You're going to have to pay for your own defense on that one. So that was interesting. We saw that revelation this past week that contemporaneous notes by two Department of Justice senior officials from a phone call from Trump post-election revealed that Trump was pressuring them to declare the election quote-unquote corrupt, and then congressional Republicans that will take care of the rest. Just leave it to me. The Department of Justice officials declined on the entirely sensible, aspect that there was actually no evidence that it was corrupt. There's plenty of evidence that Trump himself is corrupt, but that's another story. That is important from a legal standpoint because it shows a criminal intent on behalf of Trump. So if he were to be prosecuted for trying to interfere with the outcome of an election, there are a number of relevant federal statutes for that. One of the elements that you have to be able to prove that is that Trump was knowingly trying to interfere with an election in a way that was not kosher. And remember that he is already being investigated in Fulton County, Georgia, for his phone calls to the Georgia Secretary of State and other Georgia election officials, also trying to influence the election. And he also placed similar calls to officials in Arizona. Don't know if that's being investigated yet, but, stay tuned. We also, found out this week that, speaking of Arizona, the Arizona recount is now officially over in Maricopa County, and it found absolutely nothing. It's going to cost local election officials several million dollars to replace all the voting machines that were tampered with by partisan Republican operatives. But after all that publicity and months and months and months and months and months of quote-unquote auditing the 2020 election results, they found absolutely nothing untoward at all, which shouldn't be a surprise. It's maybe only a surprise that they didn't try and invent something. Actually, they did, but it hasn't flown. Just trying to keep it short. But that's some of the stuff that is keeping the former guy in the news this week.
And Maria, medical debt of Americans.
Yeah, there was a little noticed study published a little over a week ago in the Journal of American Medical Association, which found that Americans' medical debt is approximately twice as high as anyone had predicted. It totals about $140 billion and is the highest source of debt in collections in the United States. About 18% of Americans hold medical debt that has gone to collections. So, of course, this is not a complete picture of overall medical debt in the United States because it only measures debt that has been sold to collections agencies. Many hospitals choose to pursue debt on their own and file lawsuits against their own patients in order to try to collect, which can lead to really high legal fees and wage garnishments for their patients. In addition, and of course, bankruptcy. In addition, some patients choose to pay their medical bills with credit cards that rack up fees and interest charges, and that's considered credit card debt, not medical debt. This study also doesn't account for medical debt that was incurred because of COVID-19, since the data was collected before 2020. Notably, most of this medical debt that's in collections is in states that chose not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, particularly highly populated southern states from Texas all the way over to the Carolinas. Medicaid availability tends to eliminate long-term medical debt that can lead to bankruptcy. No surprise there, right? Medical debt, I have to say, too, is particularly hard because you can't choose whether or not you incur it. So, for example, if you're poor, you can buy a cheaper car, so you don't have as much automobile debt, right? Or you can buy less expensive clothes. You can, you know, but if you get sick, you often can't choose a cheaper doctor, a less expensive hospital, or a cheaper form of medical treatment because the medical establishment is not transparent in how they price their services. And that's something that is a wide open area for reform and something that that a lot of groups are trying to get the federal government to push reform on.
Yep. Similarly, and this it was the Urban Institute study that I was thinking of earlier. Medicaid expansion was one of three significant areas of government aid that dropped the poverty rate by an unprecedented nearly half in the United States in the past year. And that does not include the child tax credits that went online this past month. So, which are estimated to drop childhood poverty in half. So, who would have thought it that you give poor people money and their lives get easier?
Those programs like stimulus checks and an increase in food stamps and the extra unemployment benefits have lifted about 20 million families out of poverty in the U.S. in the past year, cutting the poverty rate by almost 50%.
Yeah.
So that's a really good argument for a guaranteed basic income, right?
Yes, it is. In general for expanded social safety net programs.
Mm-hmm. Now, Republicans are against these anti-poverty programs because they believe these programs discourage work and marriage, right? That's the work and marriage mantra. But, you know, many families live below the poverty level when they have one adult or both adults working in the workforce. And it's not the government's business whether people get married or not, but it is the government's business to set the minimum wage. And the federal minimum wage is at an absolutely unlivable $7.25 per hour.
Has not been raised in something like 20 years.
Yeah, in a generation. So it is past time that that Congress do something about that. And I know a lot of progressive Democrats in Congress have been really pushing for an increase in the minimum wage.
All right. Yeah. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time. I want to remind people to get your ballots in.
Yes.